everybody waiting online. This is Betsy with the Legislative Information Office. I just wanted to let you all know that the meeting that's happening in Anchorage, they're trying to figure out the technology right now. So they will be calling in shortly, but just sit tight.
Thanks, Betsy.
No problem.
Thank you. Michelle, is that you?
That is. Is this Jack?
Yeah, hi. How's it going?
It's good. How are you, Jack?
Good.
Thanks for being here.
I didn't know you were on. I assumed I was on here all by myself, so there's probably some other people on.
Probably, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to sign off. I mean, I'm going to just go mute.
Sounds good. Me too. Talk to you later.
Thanks, John.
Hello?
apologize for
okay.
communication gap.
Thank
on
you,
that.
Fellas.
That happens a lot.
Thank you, fellas. Good afternoon, and welcome. My name is Meade Treadwell. I'm Lieutenant Governor of Alaska, and we're here in Kodiak where we've got a couple of folks in the room, and I apologize for the fact that we had a few technical difficulties, but we're now ready to move forward with a hearing on a public hearing on ballot measure 4, an act providing for protection of Bristol Bay wild salmon and waters. This is hearing number 5 of 8 that we're holding, and for those of you listening in online around the state, we'll also have one this Wednesday of this week in Anchorage at the Dena'ina Center from 4 to 6 p.m., one next Tuesday from 1 to 3 p.m. in the Fairbanks Assembly Chambers, the Borough Assembly Chambers in Fairbanks, and next Thursday, a week from this Thursday, October 2nd in Dillingham at the Legislative Information Office. We're honored again today to have Anders Gustafsson, and is it Alicia, are you on representing the Alaska Miners Association?
Yes, and Jason Bruni is here as well.
Okay, Alicia and Jason, and thank you both for joining on this. Our agenda today, very simply, is to present a summary of the bill and then go through the pro side, where Anders will speak for the bill, the con side, where the Alaska Miners Association will speak against the bill, and then accept public testimony and questions. Moving quickly to a summary of the proposed bill, this bill would attempt to provide protection of Bristol Bay wild salmon and waters within or flowing into the designated Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve by requiring legislative approval for certain large-scale metallic sulfide mines. It would require a law finding that the proposed mining operation will not constitute danger to the fishery within the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve and would be in addition to other permits and authorizations already required for such mines to operate in the region. The sectional analysis of the bill, in the first section, there is a new statutory provision with three subsections to be added to Alaska Statute 38.05.142, legislative approval required for certain large-scale mines. In addition to permits and authorizations otherwise required by law, the legislature must give final authorization for any large-scale metallic sulfide mining operation located within the watershed of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. The Commissioner of Natural Resources would be in charge of adopting regulations under the Administrative Procedure Act to implement the statute. It defines large-scale metallic sulfide mining operation as, quote, a specific mining proposal to extract metals, including gold and copper, from sulfide-bearing rock, and that would directly disturb 640 more acres of land, close quote. The other sections of the initiative would add new provisions to the uncodified law of the state containing 10 specified findings by the people. The findings would generally provide for recognition of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve as a region of statewide significance to sport, commercial, and subsistence fisheries, Alaska's economy, the global fishing economy, and a region of cultural importance to Alaska Natives. The provisions outlined in the initiative do not retroactively take effect on any existing mining operations throughout the state. Now, let me just say that that's the summary of the bill and its provisions. The actual bill itself, the Bristol Bay Forever Initiative, is on the table here for people to take a look at. And what happens if this bill is voted on by the public and there is a majority favoring the bill? We certify the election either way about 15 days after the election, and an initiated law becomes effective 90 days after certification. So assuming that it's sometime mid-November that we certify the law, if it passes, it becomes effective in February. This law is not subject to veto, and it may not be repealed by the legislature within 2 years of its effective date. That's according to Article 11 of the Alaska Constitution. And although the legislature may amend an initiative at any time after it's enacted, any amendments made during the first 2 years may not operate to effectively repeal the initiative by amendment or to vitiate the intent. And that's described in several court cases that have clarified that that method of how an initiative takes place. Let me just say that we also asked, as we do with every initiative, for a cost estimate of the bill, and the cost of the Department of Natural Resources was estimated at about $70,000, and that was $52,000 in personal services, $14,000 in travel, supplies and materials, $4,000. And the Alaska Department of Natural Resources Office of Project Management and Permitting coordinates the review of large-scale mines in the state, and they would be presenting information to the legislature. There were some other provisions that some other expected costs. The state legislature estimates that they will need to spend $50,000 with advising agencies. Actually, that would come from the Department of Law, and I need to correct the record in this case because I've been saying, and our slide actually needs to be fixed, Cameron. I just realized this. We've said it was a cost to the state legislature, and it's actually in our cost estimate. It was the Department of Law estimating $50,000. And I will say that the legislature occasionally hires consultants on this issue as well. The Division of Elections for running these hearings for the cost of this initiative and is part of the three initiatives that are on the fall ballot. The cost of the ballot, voter information pamphlet that goes out around the state and so forth, estimates $71,257. So all told, the cost of the overall cost of the initiative is expected to be about $150,000. I'm now going to move to invite the pro side for this initiative to come forward and speak at the podium. And we'll be calling up a slideshow. For those of you who want to see the slideshow, I believe you're going to have the same slideshow that that was presented in some of the earlier hearings, and that can be found at notice.alaska.gov, and at the banner at the top of the page there you'll find exhibits that have been provided on this initiative and the other initiatives on the ballot this year. And so, Anders Gustafsson, could you identify yourself and the organization you're with, and we look forward to your presentation.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor.
Push the button.
All right. Thank you again. Appreciate being here. It's nice to come back to Kodiak. Having guided here in the past, it's always fun to come back to the island, especially on a beautiful, sunny day, which you have all the time here, I think. Again, my name is Anders Gustafsson, and I'm the Executive Director of the Renewable Resources Coalition and Foundation, an Alaska-based nonprofit whose mission is to protect hunting and fishing and the resources that they depend on in the state of Alaska. We've been active in the protection of Bristol Bay salmon since 2005 when we were created, and we are a strong supporter of ballot measure 4 for the following reasons I'll go into in our presentation. To start off with, I would like to just, you want to advance the slide, that'd be great. Just wanted to highlight a little bit of history about the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve as well, just for folks who are unfamiliar with it, as it is a fairly unique area of our state that has been established, and it is the only fisheries reserve in the state of Alaska, and I assume the only one in the country at this. The Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve was created in 1972 by then-Governor Jay Hammond, who was actually a senator, at the time, and that was when the state was looking to rapidly develop its oil resources across the Arctic and other places. They had the wisdom at that point to identify the Bristol Bay fishery as something that would need to be protected and wanted to add another layer of protection for that fishery. So they created the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve, which stated that any oil and gas leasing in the region would also be subject to an approval of the legislature. We've taken this existing protections, and originally when we discovered that this was actually there in some of our preliminary research on Bristol Bay and how could we get to this point where we have 1,000 square miles of mining claims in the middle of this important fishery, we determined that the fisheries reserve had been created only for the threat of oil and gas, and that was because it was created in 1972, and that was far long before anything like Pebble Mine was ever discovered or talked about in the area. So the effort has been put forth to try and amend this existing legislation that is specific to Bristol Bay watershed and does not affect other areas of the state to amend it to be meeting the current threats that we consider to be a threat to the Bristol Bay fishery. Bristol Bay is home to the largest sockeye salmon run in the world, and it contributes somewhere between $300 to $600 million to the state's economy. And beyond that, has about a $1.5 billion impact to the United States economy, which is a very, very important resource for Alaska to protect. You can advance for me, please. The law was intended, of course, to protect the fishery from non-compatible development, and we feel that large-scale mining at the size and scale of Pebble Deposit and others that would be made possible if we were to open that door would be incompatible with the fishery. As I said before, it was created years before the initial discovery of Pebble. Therefore, it was missing any kind of language that would address that. Jay Hammond, of course, has always been quoted, often been quoted as on the Pebble Mine issue, as saying there could be no worse place for a mine unless it were in my kitchen. I think he would be with us today if he was here to help us support this bill. And it again established a history of protection for salmon in Bristol Bay, and I think that it's important that we continue that trend here in Alaska. Next slide, please. This is a map of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve we put together just to show people the size and scale of this. It's pretty impressive. And in the center, you can see all the orange area. That's all mining claims that were established after the Pebble Deposit was promoted as being one of the largest, richest deposits of gold and copper. A lot of other mining companies came in with the boom and staked claims throughout the region, over 1,000 square miles. So Pebble would just be the proverbial nose under the tent if we were to start to develop this area for the large-scale hard rock mining. Again, I want to point out that this is set up to set restrictions for large-scale mines. This does not affect placer, small mom-and-pop mine operations. There's a very few of them in the region. There are a few in the watershed. You would have to meet a threshold of over 640 acres, which is a square mile of impact. So we're looking at the large-scale mineral development. Next slide, please. So we have a few reasons why we think we support it at a very basic level. One of the things is the economic protections of this world's wild salmon fishery. Now, with 50% of the world's wild salmon coming from Bristol Bay, we find that that's a worthy resource that would deserve an extra level of scrutiny and an opportunity for the public to weigh in and have their say in whether a large project that would impact this entire region and fishery was something that the state of Alaska and the people of Alaska would want to pursue. And basing that opinion on the requisite danger, would it put the fishery at risk? You use the word danger in the legislation, and that's the equivalent of risk as opposed to the legal equivalent of harm where you would actually be killing fish. So the question is, can you or should you build, say, the world's largest earthen dams where you could have a catastrophic failure, as we've seen at the Mount Polly disaster in British Columbia? Should you allow that kind of risk to take place? Again, we think that if the oil and gas has to follow these rules and has had to follow this rule since 1972, it's only fair that large-scale mining should be following the same set of rules now that they are looking to open that area. Again, the reserve creates an annual economic impact of $1.5 billion to the country, something that's definitely worth our legislators' time and effort. It's been pointed out that by the opposition that this would add a burden, an additional burden to the legislature. I don't think protecting the world's largest wild salmon run is something we should take lightly, and I think it's just as important as many of the things that are discussed in the legislature today, if not way more. And again, ballot measure 4 is specific to the Bristol Bay watershed. We often hear about laws that come into place that are would affect other areas of the state or other mineral deposits or any other project that we'd be working on. And it's really important that what we've always said is that it's the wrong mine in the wrong place, and this is really about this fishery more than it is about mining. We're not against mining. We're against putting our world's greatest fishery at risk. So by amending the existing Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve, we are specifically addressing the issue of that and keeping it in the watershed. Thank you. Next slide. Oh, I think we went the wrong way. I think one of them might just be a pictures. You can fast forward through these. It's just for showing it around. And just going a little bit deeper on how we believe that this will help protect our salmon. Currently today, with the large-scale mine and permitting process, typically these decisions for whether a permit will be issued are done in individual silos. You'll actually ask for a water. You'll ask for a permit to a dredge and fill permit to a be able to put a road or putting in a ditch. Each specific instance or permit isn't necessarily looked at as a cumulative in a cumulative fashion by the state. We don't look at it and say, well, what's going to be the final impact if we allow this road to be built, this dam to be built, and then this thing to be built. Each one of those is a case-by-case permit, and we like to see that there's a more of a public process where Alaskans have a say via their legislature whether we think that this would put a danger to the fishery. Again, we've highlighted the word danger. Danger is basically the equivalent of risk. So is it appropriate to put the world's largest dam on top of the world's largest salmon run? Is there a risk there, and what is the reward for that? And again, it puts the agency approval process out into the public arena as well. One of the things that we've heard as a criticism with the permitting process is that typically unelected bureaucrats are making these final decisions, and there's no one on the record from an elected official standpoint giving approval. And we would like to have the opportunity to have our elected officials and people from around the state, since Bristol Bay fishery does affect the entire state and isn't that has been determined that it's a state resource, an important state resource. We'd like to have that process being out in the public and not just behind the doors of an agency. Next slide, please. There's lots of questions, so I'm happy to answer the questions. In summary, I just always wanted to end with Ted Stevens' quote, just how we were saying about this watershed being the important thing that we're trying to protect, that he's not opposed to mining, he said, but this is the wrong mine for the wrong place. And again, it's all about that place, and this is where we are with ballot measure 4, trying to enact an additional level of protection and public process for Alaskans to have a say of whether large-scale mineral development would ever be allowed inside of the world's greatest salmon fishery watershed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, I'm sorry. Thank you very much, Anderson, Mr. Gustafson, and we will invite you up here to when we get to questions and answers. I'd now like to turn to Alicia and Jason with the Alaska Miners Association for your presentation. You're on. And do we have a slideshow? We don't have a slideshow. If you could keep this slideshow up, or at least keep the map, and keep the map of the fisheries reserve up, that would be useful to have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So my name is Alicia Amberg. I'm Deputy Director of the Alaska Miners Association. We represent all of the large mining operations in the state of Alaska, as well as the 300 placer mining operations. Our job at Alaska Miners Association is to ensure responsible, environmentally sound development. So Ballot Measure 4, the Bristol Bay Forever Initiative, stands to politicize the permitting process by requiring legislative approval in addition to the existing National Environmental Policy Act processes and other permitting requirements that would take place at a mine in the Bristol Bay region. We believe there are already comprehensive approaches to the permitting process, as hopefully DNR will elaborate on later in this hearing. So the problem with citizen initiatives, we believe, is that they have too many unknowns, and this is no exception. It brings uncertainty to Alaska's investment climate and sets a bad precedent that can easily creep into other venues in Alaska. It will certainly pose additional burden to the legislature and permitting agencies, and without any added benefit to the environment. Now, I also want to make note of Anders' comment about the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. So mining was envisioned and talked about, and it was intentionally omitted initially. For mining, the initiative places restrictions in place after mining claims have already been staked and $500 million in exploration and environmental studies have already been completed by the claim holder. Changing up permitting standards at any time after the process has begun not only puts Alaska at a competitive disadvantage, but it's just not fair. So above all this, the initiative is very likely unconstitutional. The constitutionality of the existing Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve has never been tested in courts. Our Constitution prohibits special and local legislation. And most importantly, the separation of powers has had serious concerns expressed by at least one Alaska Supreme Court justice. So finally, we think it's important to take note that Ballot Measure 4 will not stop Pebble. Should the Pebble Project submit a mine plan and receive the multitude of permits such a project would need, then denial by the legislature at that point would be purely political. Alaska's permitting process should be scientific, not political. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the Vote No 14 position.
And Lieutenant Governor, this is Jason Bruni. I have a few things to add to that as well.
Thank you. Dr. Bruni, please go ahead.
A couple of things. First, when the state selected the land in that area, it was selected for its mineral potential. The area was envisioned for mining and for its mineral potential a long time ago. In addition, I submitted for the record at the request, your request last hearing, Lieutenant Governor, a legal memo on SB 152, which was authored by Donald Bullock. And I'm going to highlight a couple of key points from this memo. It states within it, and I quote, requiring legislative approval for permitting and administration of regulatory programs by the executive could be challenged under the separation of powers doctrine, end quote. It further states, quote, the bill could be challenged as violating the prohibition against local and special legislation in Article 2, Section 19. And it continues, given the narrow scope of the bill and the regional limitation, it may be challenged as local or special legislation, end quote. Finally, this memo addresses the takings issue as well. It says, quote, if the state now takes those rights or imposes such extensive requirements for necessary permits that the developer is denied all economically feasible use of those rights, I would consider the state may be required to pay, quote, just compensation to the owner of those rights, end quote. And, of course, from our perspective, we would consider the initiative as such. With that, that concludes our comments.
Thank you, Dr. Bruni. What I'd like to do now is invite Mr. Gustafson up, and I'm going to ask the pro side and the con side to stay on the line. Mr. Gustafson, you could actually sit at that desk there if you want to, so you can see the screen and just turn on the microphone. Now what I'd like to do is I've got a few questions, but I want to make sure that people who we know who's online. First off, is there anyone from state agencies online today? And if so, could you identify yourselves?
This is Michelle Hale, and I am with the Department of Environmental Conservation, Division of Water.
And this is Jack DeMarkey. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources, Office of Project Management and Permitting.
Okay. This is Tracy Lingnau-Nake with Regional Supervisor, Region 2 for Commercial Fisheries, to answer any questions that might come up pertaining to the Bristol Bay commercial fishery.
And is there anyone else online? Okay. Thank you. Thank you all very much. What I'm going to do now is invite anyone who would like to testify here in Kodiak to raise your hand. I guess I have Toby Sullivan has signed up. Toby, please come forward.
Good afternoon. My name is Toby Sullivan. I'm a commercial fisherman here in Kodiak since 1975. Thank you for the opportunity to state my mind on the Pebble Mine project. I'll be brief. I can't really speak to the legal ramifications of this initiative. My main concern is that a dam of this or a mine of this size in Bristol Bay provides very little reward for the amount of risk that would be entailed. I do think that the public process has not fully accommodated the residents of Alaska so far in the Pebble Mine process. I think initiative number 4, by involving the legislature, would allow the public to have access to that process in a way that it hasn't had before. I'd also like to point out that as a fisherman who lived through the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill, they built that pipeline and they set up those oil terminals with the knowledge that there probably would be a spill, but there was no process for what to do when it happened. I see the same process with Pebble. There's a fight over whether they'll build the mine. and we'll see how that turns out. But there's no process for what happens if the mine fails, if the dam fails. We saw what happened in British Columbia with Mount Polly this summer. My understanding is the dam that would hold back the toxic waste behind Pebble would be 10 times bigger than that. As far as I can tell, there's no process and no administration of any kind to deal with the spill if that dam failed, and no way to compensate all the fishermen and the industries, which would lose a lot of money if that dam failed. After Exxon, we went through 20 years of a lawsuit and ended up with 10 cents on the dollar from a trial and a punitive damage award. In Bristol Bay, I don't know. I'm afraid that same kind of thing would happen if the dam failed, which from everything I've read, it's very likely that a dam like that would fail sometime in the 10,000 years that dam is supposed to stand. So that's really all I have to say. I think that involving the legislature is a way to involve the public in a process that up to now has been managed mostly by departments within the state of Alaska, which have very little public access. DNR is one of them. I think getting the legislature involved is a good idea. I intend to vote for this, and I hope that the legislature will stay actively involved. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Let me just say before you leave the podium, we have three state agency folks online. Are there online? Are there any specific questions you'd like to ask them about how this would be done? Would you mind if I asked DNR to explain to you, or at least to tell us, because your testimony prompts questions about what kind of process there is to maintain the dam and to oversee the dam, either present in present law now?
Are you talking about maintaining the dam once it's built?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more about that.
Jack, would you speak to that issue?
Yes. Any dam within the state that has the potential of taking a life in the event of a failure is classified as a Class 1 dam. And it comes with the stricter requirements for monitoring. So once a dam is built, it continues to operate under a certificate of approval to operate. And that comes with a requirement for periodic dam safety inspections every couple of years. So that's a requirement for a third party to do a visual inspection of the dam and review any new information, operating conditions, or changed operating conditions, and report back in that regard. There's also a financial requirement on the part of the operator to provide a financial assurance to see that after closure, any monitoring and maintenance requirements are met through that financial assurance.
Thank you. Mr. Sullivan, do you have any further follow-up question?
Yeah, I was just wondering if the state has a process in place to deal with claims if the mine failed. I'm just looking at the Exxon Valdez as a previous example of no process in place, and it didn't turn out very well for most of the people who were affected. Does the state have a process in place or any plans for a process that would help people be made whole, as it were, if the mine failed and these rivers were poisoned? Thank you.
If that was directed at me, this is Jack Markey, I would have to defer that to law.
Thanks. Jack, do you know, in the case of you would have financial bonding with a mine operator, is that correct?
That's correct.
And the financial bonding covers reclamation. Does it cover emergency response costs in the case of a mine failure?
It does not. Our regs, the DNR regs, read that we do require a financial assurance, but it can exceed an amount reasonably necessary to carry out the requirements of the approved reclamation plan. And those reclamation plan costs have to be an amount that reflect the reasonable and probable cost of reclamation. So the sort of worst-case scenario concept is not included in DNR's regulations.
And is there any further provision at DEC, Michelle Hale, on this in terms of bonding or your fining capability or your capability to present damages?
Well, I would say it probably doesn't extend to, you know, damages from third parties or citizens, but we certainly have enforcement authority if there is, you know, for example, if water quality is impacted by the effluent from the mine, we certainly have enforcement authority, and that carries with it penalty authority.
And then I guess the last question is, help me understand what's behind a dam and what's the general toxicity of a dam that of the material behind a dam that, you know, might escape if there's a dam failure in a mine.
This is Jack. I could take a wing at that.
Please.
So the chemistry of what's behind a tailings impoundment has mostly to do with the chemistry of the mineral deposit itself. And so they would process the ore and extract the metals they can that they can do profitably. And then the metals that they don't extract, if any, would wind up in the tailings impoundment. So it's very much dependent on the chemistry of the deposit. So I just wanted to, since Mount Polly is on everybody's mind, in the case of Mount Polly, there aren't significant other metals in that copper deposit. And so the tailings from Mount Polly, the initial findings are that they don't appear to be impacting water quality significantly. So it's basically a quartz feldspar sand is what the tailings are made up of without a high content of other metals. And so, you know, the initial reports, I'm looking at one actually from today from BC Environmental Protection that's finding that Mount Polly appears to have no effect on the red salmon migration over the last few weeks since the accident. So it's quite variable what might be behind the tailings impoundment from mine to mine. Fort Knox is similar to that. Fort Knox has gold in it and a little bit of bismuth, but doesn't have the typically high arsenic values that we see in other deposits. So it can be very variable.
And then how about process chemicals behind the tailings dam, whether it be leftover cyanide or other materials used to take the metals out?
There's requirements for reducing the toxic levels of, for example, cyanide. And so places like Fort Knox, they easily meet those standards with a cyanide destruct circuit. And so I would offer that the often used term of toxic waste apply to some degree to some tailings impoundments and not at all to others.
Thank you. Do the proponents or opponents of the bill want to comment on either of these questions?
I could, if kind of a follow-up question. And again, thanks, Toby, for your comments and kind of highlighted a couple of questions myself, but maybe they could also answer. And I just wanted to point out, when they're talking about the bonding, one thing about that I think about is that it's basically for reclamation, not restitution. So that's a different standard, and I just want to make sure the public understands that reclamation is a and maybe DNR can tell us the difference between reclamation and restitution. And it's basically, as far as I understand it, for a human standard, so not necessarily that the area would be reclaimed for fisheries, but how it would impact human standard and human life. Another thing about that with the bonding that I am concerned about is the fact that it does not include any catastrophic failure. The cost of that bonding, if you had that failure to pay off fishermen or lodge owners, anybody who loses their business, would not be included, and then you'd be dependent on the legal system to go through, just like we did in Exxon Valdez, to get those claims. And I was curious on and how does that work when you have, or some of this monitoring and the long-term bonding for that tailings impoundment, if it's a mine that's meant to have, or a tailings impoundment that's meant to last in perpetuity, as we've heard it put, so basically forever, if a company goes bankrupt or is no longer around to pay that bonding or be sued, who is then going to be responsible ultimately for any kind of restitution that would take place in the courts?
Well, we do a couple things. With regard to the cost, quote-unquote, in perpetuity, We use a financial model when we generate the value, the dollar value of a financial assurance. So if a mine has a requirement to, which they all do, have, let's say, a requirement for monitoring for 30 years or in some cases for water treatment for 100 years or even longer than that, we calculate the annual cost for those activities. And we build in things like if you have to rebuild a water treatment plant every 25 years, we include that in the cost of staffing the site, maintaining the roads, and doing everything you have to keep a camp in place and replace a camp on a regular basis. So we calculate the annual cost of that, and then we generate a net present value amount, which is the amount that if we invest it reasonably, it would throw off annually enough money to meet those costs. So it's simply put, companies that have a recognized long-term requirement for monitoring and or water treatment have to put up a financial assurance sufficient that we could take that financial assurance and invest it through the Department of Revenue or through another mechanism, and the state would wind up with enough money to pay those costs for the long term.
Thank you. And that's reclamation. That's not the restitution that was asked in the question here.
That's right. DNR has no regulations that allow us to ask for money in the form of a financial assurance for restitution.
Lieutenant Governor, this is Jason Bruni. Can I chime in?
Yes, I was just about to call on you and Alicia, so go ahead.
Lieutenant Governor and all the attendees there, the initiative is written as it is. What we're demonstrating is a great part of the public process that goes along with regular, customary lawmaking. The public participates, amendments can be made, changes can be made. We are unable to make those changes to this initiative. We vote thumbs up or thumbs down as it is. If the legislature wants to add costs or restitution or reclamation or other things to the bonding program as a result of a failure or whatever, then it can discuss this in the regular legislative process. This initiative does not do that, and we are unable to change this initiative to do so today. And it's important that the public understand that this is good discussion that we're having, and it can be part of the process, the regular legislative process here, but this current initiative does not do this. What this initiative does is it politicizes the process. It creates a process where instead of having a regular regulatory regime oversee things, create requirements as is it they are required to do by law, approve permits, it would then go before an elected body, politicizing the process, putting additional requirements potentially in. And that, you know, this is making us like a third world country that would allow for politicians to be put off. This discussion is great, but again, this initiative is as it is written. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bruni. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify or ask questions? Seeing none in the hall of the folks who are here, is there anyone online who would like to testify or ask questions? Hearing none, there's a couple of questions I'd like to ask first of the agencies for the record, and some of them were prompted by the testimony heard here today. A question of Fish and Game of Tracy, if you can answer this. Is there any legal authorization aside from the creation of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve that explains what a fisheries reserve is? And is this the only fisheries reserve in the state? I know that we have something in Kachemak Bay as well that our office got a bunch of mail on when there was an oil rig parked there for a while. Can you describe what a fisheries reserve is and what does that mean?
Essentially, it's an area, I think, that's been recognized that has significant value to the public, and I think it provides I wouldn't say an additional protection, but maybe a higher level of scrutiny, so to speak. Beyond that, I'm not sure what legally I couldn't tell you.
Is Bristol Bay the only fisheries reserve in the state?
I think you noted the only other one I know of, and I'm Region 2, so I couldn't answer for the rest of the state, but there is a Kachemak Bay Preserve.
Okay, and I've not been able to find any kind of legislative background or any other authorization besides the set-aside language that created it that came up in the earlier hearing. And Cameron, if you could remind me, let's see, we asked Department of Law to speak about that history. A second question for the Department of Natural Resources, and that had to do with the statement made by Dr. Bruni about this land was selected for its mineral potential. What can you say about the land in the area that is affected by this legislation and DNR's history of selecting this land for the state? Was it selected for mineral potential, and what's the state current policy about prospecting and leasing in this area?
This is Jack DeMarkey. I mean, it obviously is open to mineral entry, and I think the record shows that it was selected. It came to the state as part of a land exchange, as I understand it, and largely because of its recognized potential for copper and gold deposits that are sort of the entire Alaska Peninsula Aleutian chain is recognized as having a relatively high potential for base and precious metals.
So, Mr. Gustin, did you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight, too, that one thing about that is that there was an area plan in effect for this whole region that was established in 1984 that created the hierarchy of importance of kind of what usage were first, and there was originally multi-use, recreational, subsistence, and then mineral in that order. And in 2005, that area plan was rewritten, and that was a subject of a lawsuit, and some of that area plan had been rewritten. I'm not sure if there was any substantive changes in that, but that mineral leasing had been replaced the multi-use recreation in the priority list, which was what kind of paved the way for more mineral leasing and more development in that region specifically. I just wanted to highlight that.
Thank you. Dr. Bruni or Alicia, how does the mining community take a look at that state land at this point? It's open to entry. Is it an area where how many mines or prospects would you believe would be affected by this legislation along with the Pebble prospect that is well known?
Well, I think it's fair to say that there are a number of entities that have spent hundreds of millions of dollars. I know that well over $600 million has been spent to date there. There are numerous companies who have claims in the area. But I think what it does even more so, Lieutenant Governor, is the message that it sends that an area that once had a certain type of rules and requirements can potentially be changed midstream by putting these type of restrictions on it. And so the investment climate, I can tell you firsthand from experience, the boardrooms of large multinational mining companies who have the money to be able to make these mines come to fruition are paying attention and are seeing and are worried about investment in Alaska and in the United States in general because of these type of initiatives and other actions, such as what the EPA is doing, being done after the fact. So significant economic impact is both seen and unseen, Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you. And Mr. DeMarkey, DNR is the administrator of this land. How many other actively explored mineral prospects would be affected by this legislation besides Pebble?
It would be pretty speculative to say, but I think that Mr. Bruni's insights are valid. I don't think it bodes well for future work in the area.
Okay, because I think it's important that the public know, or that at least the record know, the proponent of the legislation made a comment today about this, about Pebble being, quote unquote, the nose under the tent issue, and it would be good if at one of the follow-up hearings, Jack, you or someone from DNR might be able to look and tell us where there's other active claims in the area, just so that we've got some indication of what's affected besides just this mine.
I'd be happy to do that. I would.
Michelle, after the last hearing we had on this, or one of the last hearings we had on this, you submitted something for the record, and I'm wondering if you could help explain that now on the record. The point was made that under current water quality rules, you are not allowed to provide risk to the fish, do a permit that provides undue risk to the fishery, but I don't want to put words in your mouth or restate the regulation badly. Could you speak to that issue, please?
Yes, Lieutenant Governor. This is part of our anti-degradation policy, and it's at 18 AAC, or Alaska Administrative Code 70.015. It is the state's anti-degradation policy. I'm just going to read the short statement here. It's the state's anti-degradation policy that existing water uses and the level of water quality necessary to protect existing uses must be maintained and protected. And essentially, when we do our anti-degradation analysis, which we do when we issue or when we prepare to issue a wastewater discharge permit, we have to conclude that this is true. We have to conclude that existing water uses and the level of water quality necessary to protect those uses will be maintained and protected. What that means is, as part of our wastewater discharge permitting, we have to make sure that uses like aquatic life are protected. So the fish that swim in the streams and the rivers and the organisms that they eat, those have to be protected. So that's part of our permitting process. It's a public part of our permitting process. So we do the analysis, we publish our anti-degradation analysis with our draft permit, and then that is out there for the public to comment on. And if they find holes in that analysis, we need to address those holes.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I was just curious if you could highlight, too, and for my own edification, does that include mixing zones and any current laws on mixing zones?
The mixing zone regulations are a separate process, but we actually have to go through a very similar process when we authorize a mixing zone. We have to make sure that uses are protected in that mixing zone authorization as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the last question is for all three state agencies, but I'm going to ask the pro and con to also speak to it after we hear from the agencies. It was asserted at least twice today that one purpose of this legislation is to bring the decision-making, quote-unquote, out in public, not just behind the doors of the agency. And I'm wondering if, for the record, DEC, DNR, Fish and Game, DNR being the leader on large-scale mines, can tell us what is the public involvement in the process under the existing permitting system now, and what capabilities are there for elected officials who are directly responsible to the public to change or modify the permits as the permit process moves forward.
Yeah, this is Jack DeMarkey at DNR, and Michelle, I'm sure, would want to add a level of detail to what I'm about to say. But we as a coordinated process on the state side, we try and coordinate our public comment period. So for issuing both DNR and DEC permits, we for large mines, we endeavor to have those public comment periods coincide with each other. There are different requirements between the state agencies for public notice. So on the DNR side, for mine reclamation and plan of operation approvals, there actually is not a requirement for public notice, but there is a practice on the DNR side to public notice them for more transparency. And that's been going on for about 5 years. So we do public notice our major mine permits, and we do public notice them with DEC. And I know we're talking about the state side, but also bear in mind that there's a federal side to permitting large mines as well. With the new large mines that are being permitted, the Army Corps of Engineers has typically been the lead agency. They're the ones that are the lead for the environmental impact statement process, and there are also public comment opportunities through that EIS process as well. So I'll give it to Michelle to comment more specifically on DEC's requirements.
Thanks, Jack. The primary, there's a lot of permits that a mine of this size would have to obtain, but the primary permits through my own division, which is the water division, are the wastewater discharge permit and also the waste management permit. We developed the waste management permit in conjunction with CNR and with our solid waste program here at DEC. There's also air permits that the air division developed. And all three of those, the air permits, the waste management permit, the wastewater discharge permit, go through a very transparent public notice process. We accept comments, and we take those comments very seriously. We're really looking to the public and to those of us that are not in the agency to review what we've done and tell us if we've made mistakes. In terms of the role of elected officials in that process, Lieutenant Governor, I would say that the role of elected officials is, in a lot of ways, very similar to the role of the general public, because they also can participate in that public comment period.
Thank you. Mr. Gustafson, would you like to comment on that further? And I'll ask the Miners Association the same question.
Yes, thank you, Lieutenant Governor. I guess it's something that's always been concerned to me as a citizen in Alaska as to how these things are considered. And I know and I appreciate the fact that these agencies are willing to take these comments and public comments and put this forward. We've seen this over the years. I believe there's usually a 30-day comment period. I think my main concern on these is that we typically hear that comments must be recorded and considered. Considered doesn't necessarily mean they're acted on. In good faith, I'm sure many of these people take these public comments very seriously. But in the end, as Jason's pointing out, that you know he's concerned that this initiative politicizes this. I think these public comment periods would also be very much political and part of it if they're taking them seriously. There's no mandate to actually take in a public's comment and do something on it. You just have to consider it. I mean, I think that's the key operative word there, that public comments need to be listened to. They don't necessarily need to be acted on. And there's no accountability for those decisions then where this law would actually add somebody, your elected official, putting their hand in the air and saying, I approve, and having a solid accountability to a decision being made as opposed to just a comment and someone taking it seriously. I'm not making fun of that. I think that that's great, and I'm sure there's good people who do that. But I would like to see it more solidified in law that the public has a process, especially when it comes to Bristol Bay.
Lieutenant Governor.
Would you like to speak to that question?
Yeah, Lieutenant Governor, I'm just sitting here shaking my head to say that there's no accountability is dumbfounding because that accountability is seen in court challenge after court challenge after court challenge when permits are issued. So there is absolutely accountability. That is categorically false. Secondly, I too would like to know, the public participates all the time in public meetings. And I can tell you for a fact that Pebble has had hundreds of them that they have hosted, and there have been many others that the agencies have hosted, and they haven't even applied for a permit yet. To say that there hasn't been an opportunity for public comment is completely disingenuous. I would like to know as well, but it's not a part of this initiative, how those comments are used. Clearly, it seems as if you get enough form letters in, an agency can use them in whatever the way they want. But again, that's not relevant to this discussion. There's absolutely accountability, and there are absolutely public comment periods, and the DNR, DEC, and the other state agencies and federal agencies take those comments and are required to take those comments into consideration all of the time. So I have a very, very strong difficulty with agreeing with what Andres has said.
Thank you. Well, I have no more questions, but I guess what I'd like to say is this, is to DNR, if Jack, if there's a chance you could present a slide or give us something for a record of the active mineral claims in the region that is affected by this, I think that would be useful to have, follow-up to an earlier question. Tracy, if there is a way that you could work with the folks at Fish and Game to find out where there's a fisheries reserve and what a fisheries reserve means legislatively, that would be very helpful to have in a future hearing. And for all three of you, probably to Jack, I don't know if you've prepared a slide or a flow paper, and there's no one here on from the Pebble Prospect that's been testifying, but I think this question of where, you know, what is the expected permit path and where is public comment there is one that would be good to have the facts for the record rather than just there is or there isn't, which is what we've heard today. Then finally, I guess I'll say is that I appreciate having Don Bullock's memo on House Bill 152. For those listening, Don Bullock was the legislative counsel who recently retired, and he mentioned the possibility of challenge to this legislation on either local and special legislation or separation of powers issues. There's not been much said on either those two issues or the takings issue, except for the discussion of what happened in the lawsuit to keep this off the ballot in the first place. And I would just generally invite all parties here to provide for the record any arguments that you'd like to see on the public record on that issue. We've heard, now heard a number of times that it's a possibility of a challenge, but you know, the specific reasons why I think are good questions for the public to understand. With that, I don't have anything else to bring up at today's hearing. I'm going to ask the pro and the con side or the agencies if we've missed anything, and otherwise we're ready to adjourn. Hearing none, I now call this hearing adjourned, and we will next be talking about this in Anchorage on Wednesday, 4 to 6 p.m., at the Dena'ina Center Connect Executive Boardroom, and I look forward to seeing you there, and I think this may be the first time when we'll have all parties in person facing each other off. Thank you very much.
Lieutenant Governor?
Yes, sir.
How can I submit those slides to you so that you could have them on Wednesday?
If you send them to cameron.eggers@alaska.gov, or I know we've got one other we've got kind of a comment on a comment email address too, but
bbaycomments@alaska.gov.
It would be bbay, so bbay comments@alaska.gov, and either way we'll get those comments both up on the website as well as available to present. And if you want to confirm that they're received or whatever, you can call either Cameron or Michaela in the Lieutenant Governor's office at 269-7460.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're adjourned.